came to America when he was 6 months old. He started as a stock boy at the grocery store. Eventually, he owned it. He turned it into the biggest grocery store chain in New York City. He now owns a real estate company worth over $2 billion. He ran for mayor of New York City. He almost won. You can't make this story up. This is the Katz Roundtable with John Catsimatidis.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the Katz Roundtable. John Catsimatidis here, Sunday morning. We have a great show for you today. We have Christine Serrano-Glasner. She's mayor of a city in New Jersey now, running for the United States Senate in New Jersey. And let's see what she has to say. Steve Cates, what is going on up in the skies? Craig McCarthy from the New York Post reporting on New York City and Albany. Governor David Paterson, and what's going on in our city, in our state? Paul Zuber, Senior Vice President of the New York State Business Council. Update on items I went through in the budget. John Schell, three-star chief in charge of all the precincts in New York. And let's start first with Mike Stoller. What's going on in the real estate industry in New York?
Good morning. This is Mike Stoller for the Stoller Real Estate Report on the Katz Roundtable. What's an alternative lender? What's a bridge lender? I'm not certain every people in my audience knows what that is. So I brought to today an individual who I respect, who I've known for probably the past 20 years, Mike Hoffenberg, who is the founder and CEO of Trevion Capital. Thanks for being here.
Michael, thank you for having me, and it's great to see you as always.
So tell me a little bit about what Trevion Capital is and what an alternative lender is.
Sure. So we really do two things. First, to our borrowers, we provide certainty of execution, transparent communication, and a flexible loan solution for them, and a shorter duration loan, typically 2 to 3 years. And to our investors, we provide principal protection, a low volatile investment, and a current income solution by distributing on a monthly basis. And alternative lenders, look, we're not a normal bank. We're not regulated by the FDIC. We provide shorter-term solutions to borrowers in need of capital, predominantly in the middle market throughout the country.
So who are your clients?
We've lent to everyone from publicly traded REITs, private equity funds, all the way down through local owners and operators. But typically, it's a local or regional owner and operator of predominantly multifamily real estate throughout the country.
Why do they come to you?
Borrowers typically come to us for what I like to say are six reasons. The first being time sensitivity. We can close a loan in 30 days or less, where conventional banks, especially today, are typically taking anywhere from 60, 90 to 120 days. The second is there's some sort of transitional nature of the real estate. Your typical buy it, fix it up, reposition it, cure deferred maintenance, add amenities, and then refinance or sell. So a transitional real estate. Third is there's some sort of transitional nature of the borrowing group or sponsorship. Maybe it's a sponsorship buyout. There's some sort of first-time borrowing group. A guy wants to self-manage, doesn't have a track record. So sponsorship-driven. The fourth being some sort of special situation.
What is a special situation?
We get what I like to call nuanced deals every single day. I like to liken it to the farmer's commercial, right? When you think about the farmer's commercial, we are farmers, right? All the weird scenarios that fall onto our desk that fall outside of the conventional lending realm, they fall into our lap, and we're able to really lend against the value of the real estate first and the situation second, underwriting to a conventional exit strategy. The fifth is construction completion. That's an area of the market that's really underserved from a capital perspective. Not many guys like to step into a project midstream, 50 to 90% complete.
Will you go into a project that has not started construction yet?
We will do ground-up construction as well, but the majority of what we do is construction completion. We help our borrowers get to a certificate of occupancy. Maybe they have a maturing construction loan. They need to replenish reserves. And then we'll allow them to stabilize the deal as well during the duration of our loan, which our loans are typically anywhere from 2 to 3 years with options to extend. And then the sixth scenario as to why borrowers come to us, which is definitely prevalent in today's financing markets, are senior stretch loans.
So explain to me and my audience what a senior stretch loan is.
Sure. A conventional bank is going to underwrite to in-place cash flow today. right? And most banks, maybe the property's in transition and the cash flow or the business plan hasn't fully been executed. So we'll lend off a future cash flow and the successful execution of that business plan. And so we're able to lend more dollars than a conventional bank will, and we'll go a little bit higher or materially higher than a bank will go, and provide a one-stop shop and a seamless execution versus getting, say, a senior loan in mezz or senior plus pref. We'll stretch, do the whole capital stack, and provide a seamless execution for our borrowers.
So why don't you tell me the structure, financial structure of the rates and everything of doing a loan, okay?
Sure.
I'm an owner. I own a property in New York City, perhaps. Not too much of your business is over here. And I own a residential property. The value of my building has gone down. My insurance premium has gone up. My expenses have gone up. What can you do for me? My bank says I need somebody else to be there.
Sure. So one, we're going to spend a ton of time upfront underwriting your deal to make sure that we can execute once we sign up a term sheet, right? We're very transparent, very communicative on the way in, so that by the time we sign up a term sheet, due diligence should be a breeze and we can execute and get to a closing table without any issues, typically within 3 to 4 weeks. So you're coming to us for certainty of execution, balance sheet execution. So if you own a residential building in Manhattan and you're looking for a non-conventional loan or a non-bank lender to step in and provide you a capital solution and a flexible solution, you can come to a lender like us. We're a non-bank lender that'll provide you certainty of execution. We're going to spend a ton of time up front underwriting the deal, being transparent, and communicating with you so that by the time we sign up a term sheet and we go through due diligence, it should be a breeze to close. We specifically have two products. One is a floating rate deal, which is anywhere from, call it, 300 to 600 over, 1 point in, either a half a point to a point
over
out,
SOFR.
Over 1 month term SOFR. And we also offer a fixed rate product as well, which is, call it, 275 to 4.5 over. We have both a discretionary fund and a separate account with an insurance company. What you're going to get from us is structure light, very communicative, ease of use, certainty of execution, non-bank type of process.
What about a land loan? Will you do a land loan?
You know, I found that land's the most volatile asset class when it comes to commercial real estate. So the majority of what we lend on is multifamily, Class A, down through workforce housing. We also like industrial, student housing, some medical office, self-storage, and some strategic retail. I like to say, grab a beer, get your nails done, go drop off your dry cleaning.
What about hospitality?
It's an operating business, housing, real estate, so that's not really for us. Again, 90% of what we lend on is in the multifamily space.
So how do people find an alternative lender like you?
You know, what's interesting, I think our value differentiator right now is our access to deal flow. We're seeing 150 inbound deals that we see on every single week. So it's a lot of frogs that we got to kiss to get to our princess.
So knowing you over the close to 20 years, I'm very happy that you're doing well. And I'd like to thank Mike Hoffenberg for being here today. See you next week.
Michael, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back right after this break.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at 3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore his seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Try Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost, built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, incredible load times, and 24/7 WordPress priority support, your sites will be lightning fast with global reach. And with Bluehost Cloud, your sites can handle surges in traffic no matter how big. Plus, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. Get started now at Bluehost.com.
Welcome back to the Catch Roundtable. What is today's Governor David Patterson? Governor, there's so many things happening. Where would you like to start this morning?
Well, John, the pulse is very close to me because I am a graduate of Columbia University, so obviously has a real interest in what's going on there. And what's going on there really in a lot of ways affects the whole country. The Speaker of the House went to support the Jewish community there, and other people have gone for different reasons. Robert Kraft has called for the resignation of the president. There's a lot going on. And to clear up the confusion, what I think the problem is those who are in support of the people in Palestine, they have very, very difficult lives to lead at this particular time. But this has been going on for a long time. And even with this problem, the Palestinians voted for Hamas to actually be in a sense, the government that would run that particular area. This is a government whose stated purpose is to destroy the state of Israel. How much more clear can you get that they are the enemy? But yet, on the campuses of some of these schools, the Jewish students are reporting that they are being called Zionists and companies are making money off of the war in Egypt. Companies make money off of wars wherever they are. But at this particular time, for those of us who are Americans that, try to weigh the situation and be fair to both sides, you can't come up with any other conclusion than this was an outrageous attack on Israel. It killed 1,200 people. There are hostages that haven't been seen since that day, October 7th of 2023, and they deserve some kind of support. And I'll just have to tell you, back in the 60s, when Martin Luther King was marching on Washington and he was fighting for civil rights and he was challenging many of the segregation policies that still existed in this country, and you would have thought that he was a terrorist, the way they referred to him at that particular time, 65% of the whites who marched with Dr. King were Jewish. And so I feel
well,
sort of
also,
a responsibility.
My Archbishop, Archbishop Yakovos from the Greek Orthodox Church, marched with Martin Luther King.
He sure did, John. And I met him toward the end of his life and went to his house up in Westchester. And he told me the whole story. His picture is on the famous Life magazine cover with Dr. King and some of the other civil rights leaders. So there was a contribution from the Greek community and others, but the Jewish community is practically 2/3 of the people who were there. And I think at this point, they deserve somebody to stand with them, and I'm happy to do it.
Let me say one other thing. Eisenhower sent in the troops to, Little Rock? And then John Kennedy sent in the troops to resolve racial issues or hate issues back in the 50s, 60s. Do you remember those?
Oh, absolutely.
How long do we allow this to go on? And the other question is, at Columbia, how many of these students are students and how many are paid agitators?
Well, in California, when this all started, what they did out there was they allowed the students to protest as long as they had their student IDs. And of course, that minimized the number of people who were protesting. It also gave you a better idea of who the people were, because outside agitators are always waiting to get involved in these situations. And they did it so quickly this time that I am very suspicious about where all this is coming from, because there's a kind of an anarchist flavor to what's going on these days. Whereas when I was at Columbia and we used to protest about things, it was about the war in Vietnam. It was about civil liberties. It was about issues that even if you disagreed with the students, they had a right to stand there and protest. And they did it peacefully, and they did it forcefully. Eventually, they got their point across. But this is a situation, I think, that's crying out for leadership. And I don't know that people are standing up and being as proactive as they could be.
And we didn't joke about it, but we made a thing. I mean, all the women's groups, because some of these people hate women, and women have no rights in those, some of those countries. And the gay groups, these people hate gays and throw them off the roof in some of those countries. And
I don't understand how a LGBT supporter or somebody who is of that ilk would be supporting this, because this is a group of people who have very, very, very provincial points of view. I mean, they would be a lot more popular in the Byzantine era than in 2024, which is what we're seeing.
The leadership of Columbia University. There was a president there that was there forever.
McGill was president of Columbia for a long time. And
yes.
Then Bergoni was there.
Yeah. And now she's only there for 8 months.
I went to a breakfast with her when she was named President Shafiq, and a very warm person, I think a real educator. And this is the problem, is you put presidents of universities into these situations. I mean, I dealt with these civil disobedience situations, people standing in front of your office and that type of thing. These presidents don't have that experience. What they need to do is to bring in the people who have had that experience and listen to them. And the other thing is that I think that these university presidents, and one of them from Harvard got fired for this, when you go to these hearings, show some humanity, show some emotion about what happened in these situations. Don't sit there like you're at a house closing or an interview on finance or something like that. And I think that's where they got in a lot of trouble. It wasn't even as much what they said, but how they said it, and missing that moment when a public official connects with the public, which is there are a lot of people in politics who are very good at doing it, and it's something that I think is missing from the academic industry, and they need to create a course and send some of these presidents to it. Because that's where they, in the beginning, that's where they missed the boat. And then they went on, and a lot of them got themselves in a whole lot of trouble.
Thank you, Governor Patterson, for coming on. And God bless you and God bless America. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
The Cats Roundtable.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Imagine being the first person to ever send a payment over the internet. New things can be scary, and crypto is no different. It's new, but like the internet, it's also revolutionary. Making your first crypto trade feels easy with 24/7 support when you need it. Go to Kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures, Inc., PVI, DBA, Kraken. Visit PVI's disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
With us today is Steve Cates, otherwise known as Dr. Sky. And he entertains us every Sunday morning when, you know, when we look up in the skies, what do we see? And Steve Cates, what's going on right now?
Well, good morning and happy Sunday morning to you and the listeners, John. We begin with a story that we've talked about, but an update. The Voyager 1 spacecraft. How about this? It resumes sending good data. Well, John, 5 months ago, Voyager 1 was sending back garbled data, as I reported here on the Cats Roundtable, at 15 billion miles from the Earth. Well, the problem, John, was found in what they called the FDS, Flight Data Subsystem. That's a computer which packages data, which sends it back to the Earth. A chip in that FDS was the problem. So they resent the entire code again to communicate with the spacecraft in little pieces to put it on another part of a chip. Well, guess what? Apparently it worked. I'm amazed, and I'm sure you and the listeners are, that something 15 billion miles away, which signal takes 23 hours to at least get there, that's incredible. I mean, at least we know now that the spacecraft is somewhat healthy, more than it was. Amazing.
How did he, if the chip was bad, how did he divert it to, was there a backup chip?
No, John, apparently what they did, they know how to sector the chip. So apparently they resent, in other words, you kind of wash out the old data, and then they decided to put it into another portion of that tiny little chip. Well, to me, that sounds like just a miracle. And I guess these space scientists ought to be at least applauded.
So Voyager is not dead. Yeah. Voyager is giving us information.
It's giving us information. But here's the most amazing part, John. This is something I haven't reported before. The signal, when it gets to the Earth, is less than what we call an attowatt. What the heck is that? That's a billionth of a billionth of a watt from a 12-foot dish that's on the spacecraft. And it sends data back and forth at 2.3 gigahertz and another frequency at 8.4 gigahertz. But even that sounding a little off the record and a little bit bizarre, how can you pick up a signal that tiny from a giant radio telescope? That, to me, is most incredible. So here we go, John. There's some more things to talk about Mars, as you and I like to talk about
it. I always like to talk about Mars. I think we're going to find something up there one of these days.
I hope so, but here's the latest data on something. The Mars sample return mission is over budget. Well, the Perseverance rover is collecting these Martian rock soil samples and storing them in these tubes for a potential future mission called the sample return mission. It would be an orbiter sent to go to Mars, a lander, and a drone to pick up these little tubes and send them back to the Earth. That sounds like science fiction, but the budget, it's over budget. It's about $10 billion, so the mission may or already have been canceled. But, John, the little craft that you like to talk about, and me too, is the Ingenuity helicopter. We know it won't fly anymore, but it's still sending back images of the sand and sending back weather data. So the story of Mars gets more interesting every week.
Wow. And any future missions, any future missions for Mars by us or any countries?
Well, the Japanese are going to send a mission. I think we reported this many months ago, but here's an update. There is a Phobos, that's one of the satellites. They're going to either look at, taking more pictures of it or maybe scoop up some samples of it. As you and I talk, those moons are extremely weird, which leads us to the mystery of the week, John. Here's another one that's bizarre. Here's the question. What's the interior of the moon like? And scientists with new data, how about this? Tell us that the moon has a semi-solid core that's about 160 miles in diameter for its radius, I should say radius. And it has an outer fluid core that's about 225-mile radius. But the moon still continues to give off moon quakes. We knew this from the Apollo mission. But here's the problem with the moon. It's not hollow. It's not made of cheese, of course, if that's a joke. But anyway, the moon lost its magnetic field about 3.2 billion years ago. And the strangest part is many people now believe the moon was formed by a Mars-like sized object that hit the Earth called Theia, and out of that big bubble of plasma and, magma and material, it helped to form what we call the moon itself. So the moon mystery continues. Obviously, this is a fascinating story, that the moon is still somewhat active, and I found that to be fascinating, don't you?
That is fascinating. I mean, I remember the movie where the moon was hollow. I mean, that was a good movie.
Absolutely. Great special effects for that.
Yeah.
But, John, in the sky, we wrap it up here. We always talk the live sky. The moon, of course, just passed this beautiful full moon called the full pink moon in honor, of course, of the celebration of the Passover season. But we look in the sky and we find out that the planet Jupiter is easy to see. If you just look into the west just after sunset, It sits there shining brightly, and over half a billion miles away, telescopes reveal the beautiful satellites, at least four of the main ones. And you can learn so much more, as we always say proudly. Go to the Dr. Sky Experience where? Of course, WABCRadio.com. Great information, John, as you and the listeners know. Thank you for the compliments. From astronomy, space, aviation, and weather. And then, of course, stories from American exceptionalism, as we need that. Don't you think we need Superman at a time like this?
Right? We definitely do. Thank you so much, Steve Cates. Have a great rest of the weekend, and we'll catch up with you again real soon.
Thank you, John.
You are listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Chief John Schell. He's Chief of Patrol. Chief, welcome to Sunday morning show. And tell us, what does the Chief of Patrol do? You're in charge of all the precincts?
So I'm in charge of Patrol Services Bureau. That's 77 precincts. It's about 15,500 cops, sergeants, lieutenants, and captains. And I also have a staff of about 3,500 civilians. So about 19,000 plus. It's the largest bureau in the police department.
Tell us, how is... what would you normally have if we didn't lose so many police officers to retirement and the budget?
So right now we should have about 35,500. We're about 3,400 right now, so about 1,500 down. But we have 1,200 kids in the academy right now. I call them kids, still apologize. And we have an additional, the mayor gave us an additional green light for another 1,200. So that's a raw number. And I'm happy to say right now it's about 3,000 cops that could retire, and not one is put in for retirement yet. So right now that's going to be a net number, which will get those numbers back up where we should be.
Albany has passed a new law, supposedly deal better with the bail law. And I don't think the average consumer or the average citizen of New York understands it yet. Do you have an understanding? Did you get a briefing on that yet?
A slight briefing. I got to dive more into it. But really the protections are for the workers who get assaulted during retail theft. And then there's some stiffer penalties for retail theft. DA's office through bail reform. So hopefully that will curtail the influx of retail theft we had in the last couple of years. We're up slightly this year. We were down slightly last year. But probably the number one complaint in terms of crime is retail theft. Nobody wants to go into a store and have to ask the store clerk to get a key to take his toothpaste out. We shouldn't be in that place.
It's sad, very, very sad.
Absolutely. They're the core of New York City, right? They are the people, at the end of the day, the workers, the midnight workers. Those are true New Yorkers that make this city go.
The chief of transit is a different chief, and you were telling us some statistics on transit, that things are going in the right direction on transit?
Right. So Chief Mike Kemper and his team down there, in January, crime was up about 46%. It was alarming for everyone. But his team and our police commissioner dedicated more resources, cops. And I'm glad to say right now, crime is down 5%. So that's a 51-point turnaround. And the other piece to this is, more cops make people feel safe. So there's a numbers to it, and when it's always good for the numbers to be down. But people, we're trying to make people feel safe, see us, and also deal with the homeless and mentally ill. So always looking to try to do things better. But Chief Kemper, our police commissioner, our mayor, even our governor helped out, and we're going in the right direction. We're happy about that.
The front page news the last few days has been the college campuses. I mean, it seems like it's out of control. It seems like, and I've said to people, I was interviewed myself by somebody, and I said, you have three types of people. You have people that are actually students up there. You have people that are agitators. You have people that, I don't know what else, but how do you see things? When you arrest some of them, are you able to tell if they're students or they're just agitators?
Well, let's go back to last Thursday when I was on the campus of Columbia with our cops having to remove 108 appeared to be students, whether it be from Columbia or the other school,
NYU or City College?
City College, NYU. We took the students off. And, you know, protesting is one thing. That's your First Amendment. Hateful speech it's just a totally other disgusting thing to do. And it was quite disturbing to remove the students from the campus, but the students that came out of school, out of class, and the vile language that came out of their mouth, anti-Israel, anti-police, as a father, for kids who just left college, was quite alarming to me. But the kids are back on the campus. And the problem we're having is it's private property. That's what people understand. We can't just go up there and enforce college rules. We can enforce crimes on the campus, but we can't just go up there and throw people off the campus without the school's written permission for trespassing to do so. So NYU did it quite well. That president called. She wanted them removed. And once she removed them, she had a post plan to put up boards. We haven't heard from NYU ever again. We're still dealing with Columbia and now City College. But it's really disturbing to hear the hateful speech. And I couldn't imagine what it feels like to be a Jewish person. I have to hear this and my friends, my family. It's so sad. And I wish we could do more in terms of locking these people up. I really do.
Chief, thank you for coming on. And keep it up there. Keep your people feeling good. And
John, thank you so much. My pleasure to be here. And thank you for the platform. It's people like you, stations like this, allow us to get our story out and keep New Yorkers informed of what's going on.
Thank you so much. With us today is Craig McCarthy, New York Post. He runs City Hall for them. He runs Albany for them. He used to be at the NYPD running things for Commissioner Shea and a few others. Craig, you know, I still don't feel comfortable walking around.
Well, it's a common feeling that's going on right now. The Adams administration over the last 2 years has made a lot of progress in cutting down on shootings, which has subsequently affected the tally of murders. You know, however, you know, we revealed this the other day that felony assaults are up to the highest level they've been. They're nearly 27,000. I mean, this is the highest level it's been on in recorded history, which dates back to 2000. So it would be the numbers that were kind of somewhere in the 1990s. And this year, crime is down slightly compared to last year, but it's still up 20% from pre-pandemic levels, or a little bit more than that. And there's just a sense of not feeling comfortable because of that. I mean, people more likely, with nearly 27,000 assaults, you're more likely as a New Yorker to either know someone, you know, be connected to someone, or be one of those people that had those things happen to you. I mean, another issue that's going on with crime is retail theft. But, you know, hopefully with what they're saying, hopefully will work with now changing out the law in Albany, which there's two prongs to this. They're looking to upgrade charges for anybody that assaults a retail worker. So that'll be automatically a felony. And then on top of that, which they're trying to target these recidivist shoplifters, they're going to take all these little petty larceny. So if you're hitting a store and you're hitting $50, $100, and it keeps going and keeps going, once they want to couple that together so you can hit that $1,000 mark and you can charge them with a grand larceny.
Do we have a solution yet?
I guess it's a little too early to tell. I mean, the Adams administration, the people up in Albany, they seem convinced that this is going to change things. This is going to deter those recidivist thieves that have continually hit these stores. But again, it all has to do with enforcement, right? It all has to do with actually arresting the guys when it happens. And I think a lot of people know, like I've seen it personally, of people walking to a store, clearing out a shelf, and then just walking out. You know, the store employees are being told not to address them, not to touch them for their safety. And police response times for something like that is nearly 30 minutes at this point. So there's a lot of things that have to happen simultaneously right now to address that specific problem. And we're also dealing with an NYPD headcount that has been reduced by more than 2,000 over the last few years, you know, post-pandemic, George Floyd protests, some this anti-cop sentiment. And a lot of the guys, a lot of seasoned guys, a lot of institutional knowledge there has left. So they're dealing with all of these simultaneous issues, upticks in these crimes, so, you know, felony assault, the grand theft autos, the shootings that are still high, even though they've, you know, had a 20% reduction over the last 2 years, and, you know, retail theft. There's just a lot of things that are happening simultaneously while they're dealing with the fact that they only have 33,000, I think 800 is the last headcount that I have off the top of my head. So time will tell. But again, Carl Hastie, the speaker there, wasn't for these changes to to help combat retail theft. His thought was this wasn't going to deter criminals.
Craig, the other thing, you were at the NYPD for a while, and so you know the pulse of things, and we had a big erosion of our, you know, when John Miller left, we had a big erosion of what's going on, and I guess counterintelligence, and now Christopher Wray, the FBI director, says all the red lights are on. Are we prepared? Because New York is always the target.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I was the deputy police bureau chief for the Post. I wasn't actually in the NYPD. I was in the building, and I covered them under the three administrations. You know, with John Miller leaving, listen, the NYPD has always operated for years. There's so many people in there that run that day to day. I mean, even they've said before when the commissioner is overseas that they can run this organization without that one point person. They, you know, they do have a qualified staff that trained under John Miller. And, you know, I think we saw with when the attack happened in the subway a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago now, that the response was swift, and they ended up catching the guy, that tracking down the truck. I have not seen anything in my reporting which would raise alarms and something that New Yorkers should feel unsafe for terrorist attack or anything like that.
Anything you want to report up from Albany? Anything new up there? I mean, can I put firewood? I'm going out to my Hamptons house this weekend. Can I put firewood in the fireplace yet?
I'm not sure. I'll have to double check and get through all the bills on that one. But I think
believe they made that law.
I mean, I think the top takeaways from what came out of Albany this year was, you know, there were a bunch of wins for New York City. I mean, this is something that the administration here has been fighting for the last 2 years. They are on the same page as Kathy Hochul. The mayor was out there basically had his hands together, like thanking her so much for what she did with this budget. I mean, they got all of these. They got the removal of the FAR cap. They got all of these different developer incentives to come into New York City, all these to help housing. There was the, as I mentioned before, the retail theft, the what Adams has been calling for 2 years. We also, last minute, they forced in, they managed to get in, forced through 2 years of mayoral control, which is a huge win for the mayor and his administration, so it doesn't hold over his head, so they don't make him go up there and grovel for whatever at this point. And on top of that, you know, the big thing that I think everybody has been united on is a crackdown on illegal pot shops and the unlicensed sale of cannabis throughout New York City, which we've had more than 2,000 of these shops operating, but the local law enforcement has not had the power to physically shut down these places. So when they would go in, they would clear the shelves and they would seize all these illicit drugs at this point, and they would just be back the next day. Councilwoman Gail Brewer was out there almost every other day, it seems like, at the same place. But the question is, you just asked about retail theft, and if that's a solution, we'll have to see if this is a solution. We have the manpower to do this.
Craig McCarthy, thank you for bringing all New Yorkers up to date, and we'll be talking to you again real soon.
Thanks, John. Appreciate you having me.
This is the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Paul Zuber, the New York State Business Council. Paul, how are we doing? How is the new budget treating us yet so far?
Well, you know, the new budget is, I think, a mixed bag. You know, there are some good aspects of the new budget with the fact that the governor was able to hold the line and not raise any taxes, even though there was a lot of pressure from a lot of different groups out there to raise income taxes on the wealthy and corporate income taxes. And I'm really glad that the governor paid attention to some of the polling out there. There was a recent poll by Marist College that said 37% of New Yorkers want to leave New York. So I'm glad that the governor woke up and realized that this is a major problem, and she held the line on taxes. I think the next step after the budget is the governor has to take a serious look at this climate law that we passed several years ago which I think is becoming increasingly a problem for consumers and businesses. And most recently, right after the budget was kind of lost in the news, is New York State had put a solicitation out for three new offshore wind projects. And those offshore wind projects, the solicitations were not granted because of supply chain issues. So now it is very clear that New York will not meet the goals that are required under the statute when it comes to climate change. There were two goals: 70% of the electric power needed to come from renewables, and 40% of the greenhouse gas reductions had to occur by 2030. Right now, we're probably at about 30% renewables. I think there's a belief that maybe we'll get to the mid-50s with renewables. That leads us to discussion. This isn't working.
Windmills, how much were they supposed to supply? I mean, that is a joke. The amount that they're supplying doesn't really work.
It especially doesn't work, John, when you do what many of the environmentalists want, which is have only wind and have only solar and say to everybody, we're going to get rid of every other option out there. We're not going to look at nuclear. We're not going to look at natural gas. We're not going to look at anything else. When you look at it that way, it is a joke because there won't be enough electricity. The cost of the average consumer when they're paying their electric bill is going to skyrocket because utilities have to build transmission lines to these renewable projects, which costs money. That cost is passed on to the taxpayer. So we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing here? And shouldn't we be sitting down and reshaping our energy policy in a way that works, in a way that allows for natural gas to be considered, in a way that allows for micronuclear to be considered, a way that allows for all these other forms of energy to be brought into the mix so it doesn't increase costs on consumer and it doesn't increase costs on businesses. My upstate business members have said that this climate law is a real problem. And I've actually had many companies come to me and say, you know what, we're considering leaving New York because we just can't do business with windmills and solar panels. There needs to be natural gas or there needs to be some other form of energy that works.
Out where I live in the summer, out in the East Quogue and Keogee, they're trying to put a solar farm in, and that definitely doesn't work. It gives you an infinitesimal amount of energy for all the hullabaloo you have to go through.
It doesn't work. And quite frankly, like, how do we think that we're going to take everybody off of natural gas? Do we think that the average New Yorker is going to, you know, you're going to come to their home and tell them you're shutting off their natural gas? It's not a realistic goal. It's not a realistic statute. And, you know, all you're doing by continuing to head down this path is you're guaranteeing increased costs for consumers. You're guaranteeing increased costs for businesses. And part of the problem with New York right now is affordability. And we want companies to come into New York. We want companies to locate in New York. But you're not going to have those companies locate in New York if the executives are looking and they're saying, wow, look at those energy costs. They're through the roof. I can't go there. Or I need the energy to build out my facility. You know, a perfect example is Corning is doing some incredible things with the internet fiber and using glass fiber. All that manufacturing is occurring in North Carolina. Corning is one of the oldest companies in New York State, but they're doing most of their stuff in North Carolina. It's not because they want to. I'm sure if you were to sit them down and say that it's not because they want to, it's because North Carolina is more affordable. Right. So we have to start thinking about these things in terms of having a balance.
You need some common sense in Albany. You're absolutely right. I did start speaking about small modular reactors for different states. And I know Texas wants them. I know Virginia wants them. I know North Dakota wants them. But they're like 7 years away. It's not going to happen tomorrow morning.
It's not going to happen tomorrow. And look, it is a viable option. And just like hydrogen is a viable option, but it's, like you said, it's not going to happen overnight. So why are we rushing into something when we know that we don't have the technology yet to take us where we need to be? We eventually will have that technology and everything will be fine, but there's no reason that we have to go down this path and create more problems than we need. You know, if you go to Denmark and you ask someone in Denmark about because they're all renewable out there, they will tell you it took 30 years to make Denmark, which is, you know, the size of Rhode Island, would take them 30 years to become run completely by renewables. Why do we think New York State is going to do it in like 7 years?
How is the population? Is the exodus continuing?
The exodus is continuing. We've seen that even after COVID, that New York has been leading the pack with the exodus. And like I said earlier, there was a recent poll by Marist College asking New Yorkers if they intended to stay in New York State. And 37% said they intended to leave New York State of those polled. So wow. that shows you where the mindset is right now with folks in New York State, with what New York has to offer. And, you know, again, I commend Governor Hochul for holding the line on taxes. It was a little rough with some of the housing. I think there are some pieces in there that are not great. But that being said, you know, it's not about taxes.
Can we burn burn firewood in my fireplace yet?
Yeah, it'll stop soon with the way we're headed. And you know, just a last example, I remember this last year in the budget, the governor wanted to change how you measure greenhouse gases, and the environmentalists went nuts, and they wouldn't let the governor change how you measure greenhouse gases, even though her own people said if we didn't change how we measure it, costs for consumers would skyrocket and gas prices would skyrocket, because we're the only state that has a very weird way of how we measure greenhouse gases. But that's the problem we have, the lack of common sense. So that should have been a sign to everybody like, oh, let's fix this. Let's make it work.
Yeah.
But suddenly it became a referendum as to whether or not we believe in climate change.
Or cannot use firewood.
Eventually, you are going to find it very difficult to use firewood. You're going to find it very difficult to use propane gas grills. You're going to find it very difficult in the coming years. And you're going to see more of a push to electrify buildings because of the fact that, you know, we have this climate law, which, you know, we're supposed to have these reductions of 40% greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. And the only way that you can get there is by two things: reducing the greenhouse gases from automobiles and reducing the greenhouse gases from homes and office buildings. So, yeah, things are going to change dramatically for the public.
Paul Zuber, thank you for bringing all the New Yorkers up to date, and we'll catch up with you again real soon. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, John.
With us today is Christine Serrano-Glasner, and she is now the mayor of the Medham Town in New Jersey, and she's going to run for the U.S. Senate seat against the old Menendez seat. And Christine Serrano-Glasner, how are you today?
I'm great, John. Thanks so much for having me on. And I am excited to talk about this race because we are running fast and we are running hard. And it's time that Bob Menendez is retired from this seat. And it's time that we turn it into a Republican seat because, you know, this has been a Democrat seat since 1972. And I think the voters in New Jersey are ready for me, Christine Serrano-Glasner, as the candidate. And I bring the experience. I bring the know-how. And I have a reputation as mayor and as a senior VP from New York State Economic Development and as a regional advocate for the SBA for delivering and for delivering for our residents. And that's what I'm going to do.
Your primary is on June 4th. And you have how many other people are running?
So on the Republican side, it was me and 9 men. And now it's down to me and 4 men. And I am the Trump candidate. I have been working hard and making sure that people know that we cannot withstand another 4 years of this Biden administration. It is crippling working folks, working families, senior citizens, and even our young people who are of age and want to buy homes. With these interest rates, they can't even afford to buy homes. So I am the candidate. I'm the most qualified. I'm the one who has actual executive-level government experience. I am the Republican candidate. You've got another one in there that is really, you know, a Democrat in Republican clothes. And then you've got a couple of others that are perennial candidates, one that was running for the president up until the first 2 weeks of January. So this is it. We've been doing this since, oh, gosh, this past summer, and we are really serious about taking this seat. And I don't know if you know, John, but a poll came out recently showing that if Bob Menendez runs as an independent and he says he's going to do that, then I'm 5 points just 5 points below Andy Kim. And I know that we can do this. We can take this seat and we can have a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. This is a sleeper race of 2024.
What do you think, if you were in the Senate, how would you vote on Ukraine? How would you vote on Israel?
Well, we know that Israel is our partner, and it's extremely important, more than just our strategic partner against Iran. It's extremely important that we make sure that we continue to support and show our partner strength. But it's the same thing with Ukraine. And the challenge with the Ukraine is there's no end to this. And our fellow UN nations, they're not ponying up their share. They need to contribute more than they've been contributing. They've got 90% of the vulnerability, and they've only been putting up 10%. So we need to see that, and we need to see a plan. We know that we need to keep Putin at bay, but we need to know how long is this going to go on for, and what's the exit strategy? And that's the problem with the Biden administration. There's never a plan. So I'm definitely in favor of making sure that we support the folks out there, our allies. But we need to know how long this is going to go on for, because we must protect our own border. And it is critical that we start putting money into this country right here and make sure that we're keeping, right? We're keeping the criminals out.
Well, keep us up to date. You're running for, and we got another month or so to go, over a month and a half. Keep us up to date, and we'll have you on again, and let us know what's going on in New Jersey.
That would be great. Can I get my website in there real fast? It's
yes,
Christine4NJ.com. Christine4NJ.com. That's Christine with a CH. Please come visit us. We need your support, and we're going to do this.
Thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you again real soon.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for being with us for the Cats Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Cats Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. So we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.